Hi everyone, this is Design Gossip. We're here with Mert and myself, Daniel. And this is the weekly news section, right before we interview our guest for today. Yes. Henry Drake, a artist who switched away from the field of pharmacology and neuroscience. So Mert, what have you discovered this week? Okay,
so the first thing is very small, but a tiny update. So some of the Tesla cars got an update with something called a dog mode, where if you want to leave your dog in the car and you don't want the dog to die, you just turn on the dog mode and the AC stays on while like, you know, you're doing your thing. And there's also like in the giant screen inside the car, there's the thing that says like, you know, don't worry, like my owner knows I'm here and like it's going to come back in a few seconds kind of thing. So if there are people passing by who are worried about the dog, they can actually...
That's amazing. You know,
but oddly enough, they don't have a cat mode. It is named the dog mode, so you could use it for a cat.
That's a bit catist, I think.
Yeah, you know? it's a bit disappointing, to say the least.
It's cataphobic.
What do you have?
So, today, or recently, I discovered a new material called air carbon.
Okay.
It's made by a company called New Light Technologies. And apparently it's plastic that's made from carbon sequestration.
Wow. Okay. So what does it do?
They suck in air, right? And they filter out carbon and methane. Okay. And then they make plastic out of it. Like they polymerize it with oxygen and hydrogen.
That's very cool.
No idea how it works, right? And I tried to read a bit on their website and it gives like a very superficial kind of explanation for it. I'm guessing because they don't want to explain exactly how it works.
Yeah.
That would be... not very beneficial for them, probably.
But can you use it?
So they say that you can thermoform it, like blow film, injection molding, right? And it has similar properties to TPA or polypropylene, that kind of stuff.
Right? Is it more environmentally friendly?
It is, because it's carbon negative.
What?
And in fact, the NSF or National Science Foundation. Asked Trucost, which is like an evaluation kind of company, right? To make an analysis of the carbon footprint and environmental cost of air carbon, and apparently taking in transportation and production and all of these
factors
like in mind, it is a carbon negative product.
Wow.
So basically, like when you use it, you're actually using less carbon. So like you're
producing more oxygen
You're just using something that takes carbon out of the atmosphere, right?
That's amazing.
Even taking into account all the other processes of transportation.
That's amazing. That is very cool.
And I would love to see like if anyone has been able to commercialize a product with it.
Yes.
We should maybe do something with it.
Like we should combine this with Vanta Black.
Exactly.
And everything will make sense.
Yeah.
And Anish Kapoor will be very mad.
For sure.
Okay, I don't know if you heard, but there was the trial of El Chapo Guzman, the notorious drug kingpin. And obviously he was found guilty of all counts. And he's going to go to jail for a long time.
Yeah.
And I was very interested to find out which jail he was going to go to.
Yeah.
Because he's been able to break out of everything.
Of course.
And I'm notoriously, you know, following his art.
his art of escaping.
And we don't know yet, but they say he's probably going to go to a place called ADX, Correctional Facility, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It's in Arizona. And it's called the Alcatraz of the Rockies. And it is a supermax prison. And what that means is it's designed in a way to just like, it's better if you die. It's horrible. So I'll tell you, I'll give you some details. You're in solitary confinement. So you're like your own room, 23 hours a day.
Good Lord.
Like at any given point, you don't see the sky.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a 4-inch by 4-inch window that looks at like another wall or something. Like, you don't see the nature at all.
Fuck.
And it's horrible. But it's also very interesting because like they only like there's like 400 people in this prison.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at the list and it's like, these are the people you don't want to fuck with. Like, this is the worst of the worst. Like, the Unabomber is there.
Right.
The fucking Shoe Bomber is there. Like, every, like people who are, like, who cannot be detained unless. And it has a special design where at any given point, none of the prisoners see any other prisoner.
Whoa, and wow.
The reason they're in, you know, solitary confinement, like, 23 hours a day. So what's the other hour, you may ask? It's called the exercise hour. And it sounds kind of cool, but it's not. It's a specifically designed area. It's like, they call it an empty concrete pool. It's just a concrete room. Mm-hmm. It's the only hour during the day where they can see the sky. And the sky is the only thing they can see.
Mm-hmm.
And they're alone in that room. And these people are so dangerous that the entire system was designed so that they could be handcuffed at any given moment within their room. So, like, they're never within the guard's distance when they're, like, not cuffed in chain. And I found that very interesting, you know, from a design perspective. Because it's very sad, but at the same time, like, this is one of the only prisons in the world where no one has ever escaped from.
Yeah.
And I looked at the design and I was like, you know, El Chapo, is challenge accepted? Are you gonna? Because, I mean, that's kind of the thing, right? Like, it's, you know, obviously this is a very sad subject, but at the same time, I find it very, very interesting that, you know, they're designed so that no human can escape.
It's true, yeah. Like, they had to have a meeting and have, like, a brainstorming about, like, how to create solutions for like, detaining people. So it is...
Yeah, and like, El Chapo's up, like, this is a guy who built like a motorcycle road underneath a prison.
That was apparently solar powered. So like,
yeah. So this is a guy who has style, you know. So we'll see if all this let's say prison design is going to be able to hold him back.
Wow. Oh.
So not directly design related, but I think it's a very interesting subject to be following.
It is interesting, yeah. And actually talking about like brainstorming and all this kind of stuff. I don't know if you've heard of what a design sprint is.
Is this like an agile thing? No?
No sense.
Okay, carry on.
Okay, so it was like a creative solution, solution finding sort of process designed by Jake Knapp, right?
Uh-huh.
And it's a 5-day kind of workshop almost where... the people who are in charge of trying to solve the problem, right? Like meet up in a room and there's like a series of mapping out problems and everything. Like, I'm not going to get into the details. Like, people can just Google it. In fact, if you go on YouTube and you search for AJ and Smart, they lead lessons on how to make design sprints. So you can check it out. It's very interesting. And it's a very cool... method to find solutions. And I was wondering if any like policymakers or like in the government, they use like startup-y kind of like problem solving methods, you know? Like if like Macron from France went like, okay guys, this time I am a different president and I want to make design sprints and like he gets the like in a room with people, there's like beanie bags and like coffee pots and they try to sort of like, yeah man, how can we find solutions, testing out the product, you know? And I was wondering if anyone has ever tried to do that in a government.
I feel like if anyone is going to do it, Macron's going to be the one though.
He's, like, the guy, yeah.
He's the most likely one with Justin Trudeau or him.
Justin Trudeau definitely would do.
He has been back.
Design sprints.
You can tell.
To create policy.
But I think, yeah, like, there's a methodology called Agile for software development. Mm-hmm. And I know that they do sprints and, like, this, like, sprint-based working, right? So you have, like, a fixed period of time where, you know, every day you meet up and, like, there's different kind of methodologies, right?
Exactly. Like, every day you go through a different part of the project, right? There's, like, brainstorming and there's testing and this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It's probably very similar, I'm guessing.
Yeah, and it's actually one of the reasons that most apps get updated like every 2 weeks because the software development team has like a 2-week sprint. Mm-hmm. So they start like, and then they fix the bugs and then like when that's done, they start again.
Yeah.
So that's why you get like, you know, ongoing updates. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, personally, I'm not a fan of sprints in design.
No?
I feel like I worked in a company before who tried to use sprints for design as well because it was working for the software development team.
Yep.
But what I found was that design is a creative process. And as much as you can systemize it, if you really push it, nothing cool comes out in a way. Because everything is so structured. You're like, yeah, this is, you know, I'm going to do 2 hours of inspiration, 2 hours of drawing, and then 2 hours of wireframing. And when you come to the end product, it's not as elegant as I find it's not as elegant as the organic flow of the time. The designs that come from a more organic working setup. Because it's not coding, you know, it's not okay, I'm going to code for 2 hours and then I'm done.
Yeah, but I mean, creativity, there is a way of unlocking creativity in the brain. It's not just I think it's wrong to think that there are creative people and that there are non-creative people. I'm not saying that.
I'm just saying that we should, my point of view, at least what works for me, is that I need to allow time for my brain to figure it out. And I can't dictate it to the minute.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess. But yeah, I think a design sprint is a very good solution for... It is a way, a mechanization of creativity, right? So you will probably come to a solution with a design sprint. But maybe in the future, you're going to go oh, damn, I could have had that idea during that time.
Yeah.
And maybe you just didn't have it at that point, and maybe that idea is better. But yeah, I mean, there is the divine inspiration where you just kind of it just dawns on you at some point, and you're like, oh, amazing, and yeah, sure, a great idea can come from it. But I think a design sprint is a very nice way, if you have a client with a deadline and everything, it's probably the best way of going finding a solution to a problem.
I see. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's the approach of you know, you cannot do perfectionism when it's a job. You have to work with what you have. Yeah. So something is better than nothing.
Yeah.
And I agree with that. But I also feel that if, you know, if someone, if you're a part of a team that already can meet deadlines and you're happy with your flow, you should try it, but you may find that the design sprint can make you miserable.
Yeah, of course. I mean, everyone has their own way of working, you know.
Especially if you're using Jira by Atlassian, because fuck Jira, okay? This is the worst piece of program ever created. It is absolutely horrible. I know some people who do development are gonna love it. You know what? You can love it. But I fucking hate it. It's the worst thing ever. It has killed me. At some point in our agile, you know, the trial thingy, I was spending more time on Jira than designing.
God.
It was the worst, it was the least user-friendly thing I've ever tried, and now they're trying to fix it with nice little modern design. It's not happening. Just give up, okay? Just close up shop, you know, throw everything to the trash. I'm very sorry if I offended you, but you should be offended, and you should just make a product that people are gonna find joy in, like Asana, which is also not saying much, because Asana is also shit, but it's just so much better than Jira. Okay, I'm done.
Okay, would you like a chamomile? Just to chill out, you know?
I'm done. My rant is over.
You know what? Ditto to Illustrator.
You guys should also
prioritize.
Yeah, we should make a list of all the teams who should reconsider their decisions.
There you go. I'm sorry, but having bad text editing options and having the Flair tool being more easily accessible than the text editing options is not okay. Who needs a Flair tool?
I feel like we should do a whole other podcast of us ranting. each program gets a whole 40-minute rant.
Because
I love Sketch, but I could rant 40 minutes for sure.
Yeah, yeah, there are definitely some things on Sketch that also need... But I mean, man...
Which is my favorite program.
Yeah, creating software is not easy. So still, kudos to anyone who's working on this kind of stuff. Yeah,
except Illustrator. And Jira.
Except Illustrator.
Okay, let's go to the interview.
Yeah, let's move on to the interview.
Cut. Nice.
Hi, this is Daniel from Design Gossip, and today we're interviewing Henry Drake, up-and-coming artist based in Geneva, who has recently moved away from the field of pharmacology and neuroscience. So, Henry, walk me through a bit your background, your previous studies, and kind of what's happening now in your life.
Okay, so I did a bachelor's in neuroscience and pharmacology. While I was doing that, I sort of worked in startups, in sort of biotech and genetic engineering, mainly focusing on CRISPR. And in my third year of university, I sort of decided that I wanted to take a lateral transition to something else because I didn't feel like I felt like I wanted to go down a rabbit hole of science for the rest of my life, because it felt like a kind of I could just go for a really long time and kind of just pursue down a wormhole, which would have been fun. But I wanted to do something different. I wanted to do something a little more creative, or express the ideas that I'd learned in my own sort of way, because I thought a lot of the concepts I've done in science were super quite poetic sometimes, but I felt that the brute empiricism of all the way the information is treated kind of left a lot of closed doors. And so I kind of decided, I want to play around with these concepts and these ideas in my own way. So I was like, well, I know, I didn't know much about art at the time. I liked art, but I just liked the idea of being able to rephrase things in my own way and sort of explore things, which is why I started an art degree. And then since then, I've been doing arts for about 2 years now. But
is there anything once you made the switch that you were disappointed in?
There haven't been many disappointments. There've just been a lot of sort of realizations of the difference in types of thinking, and that maybe a certain type of thinking in a scientific way of sort of following a very clear logic is really not very rewarding in art, because it kind of leaves things very narrative and didactic. And so over the last 2 years, I've really been realizing how it's not about what you're saying, really. It's about how you're saying it. And these are two very different things in both disciplines. So in art, it's really about creating this sort of poetic message about what you're trying to talk about, making it quite beautiful and interesting. Whereas in science, it's all about brute information. And if you present brute information, really brute, in an artistic way, it's pretty boring. And so it's two different ways of treating information.
But do you still have a set system for creating art? Because in science, there is a method that has been like hardened and
the scientific method.
The scientific method, exactly. And I do have a method for creating. Or are you trying to break away from that? Because in design, there is systems for how to get information about the user and then translating that into a creative solution.
I think I do find myself falling into very similar ways of producing things, which can be frustrating sometimes. But also it's nice to know how I learn and how I sort of create things. I do have a method of sort of most of the pieces I make stem from observations, and then I just sort of research them in quite a journalistic or kind of like a scientific way. So doing lots of research about certain fields. So for instance, I was sort of interested in new age spirituality and yoga trends, and I was doing a lot of research in that in terms of where they come from. And I didn't feel like it was a super creative way of coming up with something new, but it was sort of my method was sort of just doing accumulating a mass amount of information, sort of like I would in science.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's just sort of playing around with the information at the end in a different way.
And you think that your background kind of influenced the things that you're researching now?
Yeah, I think my background really did influence the way in which I research, the way in which I sort of need to know all the inner mechanisms of something, instead of just sort of why someone's doing something and sort of exactly what they're doing and what it means and what it represents. So kind of like, and science is very reductionary, and you kind of reduce everything to try like a base sense of intentive, or something that's going on. I'd say I do this a similar thing in my research. So it's quite a similar way of researching, but I feel like it's more ethnological and anthropological.
Mm-hmm.
In art, whereas in science it was a lot more scientific and And what is the it depends on the piece, but like what is the main message that you try to convey through your art, and how do you boil down your inspiration and the things that you research into something that you chew and digest and re-transfer to the viewer?
I don't know if there's a main message yet. You know, I've only been doing this for a while, and it's sort of, I'm still figuring so many things out, and I feel like there's never really going to be a clear main message, because otherwise you probably get put in a box, and also there's so many reasons for why you're doing different things, so there's no main message. I think it's, I just like, what I really like doing in art is sort of trying to gain a better understanding of observations around me and then sort of manifest them in a more poetic way. That's sort of what I try to do.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the main objective, is to sort of make observations on behavior, things that I see around me or in trends or things that I'm feeling, and sort of reprocess it or manifest, repackage it in a way that's more interesting or poetic or sort of, yeah, just sort of interesting communication.
Hmm. And do you think that it's important for an artist to find a brand that people associate them with? And like, I use brand because like that's just my own rhetoric from the world
identity.
Exactly. So for example, Barnett Newman, he's the guy who did the zips, right? Do you think it's important for an artist to kind of find something and just exploit a niche? Is that the only way for an artist to
be? I don't think that's why you go into doing it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you go into... I think that sort of happens not by your control.
I see.
If you sort of want to go at it as, I'm going to be the guy, I'm going to define myself from the start, then it's kind of redundant.
But
because there's no process of sort of discovery. Yeah, sure, it's useful as creating a life as an artist,
mm-hmm.
to have a brand which people associate to you so that you can be something to sell.
Yeah.
But that's not usually, that's sort of out of your control.
I imagine that.
Or if you have controlled that, which a lot of people do, which is good because it's how you sort of make your living. I don't feel like that is the primary reason you're doing things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I imagine that it would happen in a very organic way, but then maybe you see that one specific piece you made is getting a lot of attention, and then maybe you just decide like, screw it, I'll sell out and like I'll just do this for like I'll make a series of 50 paintings of it and sell them to the public. But like,
yeah,
the initial process is organic. I think, because if you try to be like, man, I'm gonna find the thing that I'm gonna be doing for the rest of my life, then like it's not organic, and whatever you make is just going to be like felt as just fake and kind of like people are not gonna.
But you're gonna feel it. You're gonna feel that it's fake.
Exactly.
If you find one thing that works and then just fucking exploit that, you're gonna feel that it's fake.
Hmm.
But I do think having an identity helps, and I think a lot of people wrestle with the identity that they create, and because you need to impose a certain level of identity on yourself because to do something fully, I think. But I think it should happen naturally, you know.
Hmm.
I don't feel like someone should say, okay, I'm gonna be a punk now and I'm gonna just make stuff that is always trashing on other stuff. Like, I feel like that's never your primary motivation.
Yeah.
You know, if it happens, it happens out of your control.
Yeah.
Or if you overly control it, maybe it feels too contrived, and it's not, I don't know, but you know, different ways of surviving and different ways of engineering your future.
Yeah.
But I feel like a lot of the, I don't know, for me at least, the reason for doing art isn't to create a brand identity.
Hmm. So do you think that coming from a scientific background made you a better creative?
Yeah, I think not made me a better creative. I think it's given me a different way of being creative.
Mm-hmm.
There's not one way of being creative at all. But sort of using, I'm still learning so much about art and sort of learning different ways of making, different ways of thinking. And a lot of that comes from outside of art. But having science has given me a different approach to learning and a different approach to creating. And so the more disciplines you have, the more sort of codes you sort of
know to kind of treat information.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like in terms of mixing all of these different codes and creating something that's more communicative to a greater number of people, yeah, I think it does help having a more diverse background. A lot mm-hmm. of artists that I quite like have quite a diverse background.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't just do art straight away. They might have done they would have done cinema, or they would have done some of them do like molecular biology.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
because I feel like if you have a multidisciplinary background, you have just more things to talk about. It like a more ways of seeing the world. I think that it's very important if you get stuck in a creative job, that you just like you're going through a bad period where you don't have any ideas. It's really useful to try something new that you've never tried before. Maybe you suck at it, but it's gonna give you a new perspective.
Yeah.
It's like
sometimes you don't have that luxury to try something new and fail in a certain job.
Of course not. Yeah, like you have to have the time for that.
Say if you were like a strict firm, you can't be, I'm gonna get inspired from Renaissance piano to do my accounting or something. I don't know. But no, I think having a diverse background means that diversity and sources of inspiration and ways of thinking. And I think that's what kind of leads to creativity. Is creativity for me is making something, being able to make something is the first thing. Like it's being able to finish something and see it through, and but something that's quite new and original.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to be novel. It doesn't have to be like something that no one else has done, but I don't know, it's just creative, creating, you know, it's making something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The more I make pieces, the more I realize that actually the act of finishing something and seeing something to completion and considering all the options in making something is one of the most creative parts. It's not just the initial idea of like, oh, no one's done this before. It's this, how am I going to finish this properly? And how am I going to, consider all the options and get to a finished product?
Mm-hmm.
That's for me the really creative part.
Yeah. Do you ever struggle to finish a piece?
Sometimes.
Like you don't know when it's finished.
It's so hard to know when something's finished. I talk to so many people when I'm making something. I really don't like the idea of just every idea coming from me. I usually, the initial idea comes from me. I just talk about it to myself for a really long time, but then once I'm 30% in, I'm just getting as much feedback as I can from other people. And I know that a lot of people don't work like that.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, I just see it as getting the maximum number of possible directions. It's infinite, but for me, getting the maximum number of possible directions I could take a piece in, and then considering all those options until I get to something I feel is true to the way I thought of. But it changes a lot. And yeah, but finishing a piece is one of the hardest things, and is really, I feel like, takes some of the most creativity.
Mm-hmm.
Because
yeah.
For me, creative is like to create something, you know, like, and have a finished thing that you're content with.
Hmm.
And that's probably something I've wrestled with the most. Because like, you can have a great idea, but then if you don't think of all the options where it can go, like next step, okay, well, I could go in three different directions, and then each different direction leads to different opportunities. So like, it's through this kind of tree of options until you get to the finished product.
Yeah.
And that's when it's for me really creative, is making all the decisions that lead to a finished piece.
Mm-hmm.
But that's super reductionary as well. It's super following a sequence of logic, which is also really scientific.
It is.
But that's just my way of doing it.
Yeah.
My way of thinking about creativity.
I think that this is definitely like, when you get feedback from other people, you almost test your product or like your art piece before you even start it, right?
Yeah.
And that's just like the best way to go forward.
Yeah. But so it's also learning when to listen to someone and learning when not to listen to someone.
Of course.
If you just listen to other people, it's not going to feel like your own. And
mm-hmm.
you've already feel like you've catered it to an audience before testing it. It's weird. It's always hard, but it's always at what point to kind of get the feedback, take the feedback, incorporate the feedback.
It's kind of like you take like a piece of glass that you've created, and you just break it, and then you decide which pieces to harvest from like the mess, you know.
Yeah, sometimes it turns into something completely different.
Yeah, that's the point.
Man, this is really good. If you want, we can move on to talking about like monetization and stuff like that. Because I feel like it's a very taboo subject in creative fields, and it shouldn't be, because you gotta pay the bills, you know?
Yeah, you have to pay the bills, but you can always... Yeah, for me, it's all down to initial incentive.
Mm-hmm.
That's like the most important thing. Sure, like when you make a piece, it's nice to know that you're making it to such a good, like, it motivates me sometimes where I'm like, okay, I'm trying to make this, and I don't want to fuck up. I want to make this super clean. I want to make this really polished, as long as it fits within my initial idea, but I need it to be super polished, super clean, without faults. And it's always kind of motivating, like, okay, if I do this well enough, I might actually be able to sell it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not the reason I want to make it polished, you know?
Yeah.
And it's not the initial reason I went on making the piece, but it's sort of a reassurance that if I do it well enough, I might be able to live from it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not like I'm trying to live from it.
Yeah.
Like, I can always get a money job, like working in a bar or working as a courier, or doing something. But yeah, the idea of the struggling artist kind of sucks. It's such a cliche. But I feel like in terms of monetizing of pieces, it all depends on the type of art you do as well. Like all of last year, I did really big installations that I would never be able to sell. I went into an abandoned porcelain factory, and we made like a 5-meter avalanche of plates.
Mm-hmm.
In one of the corners that kind of erupted out of one of the sort of... It was a really weird architectural feature in one of the corners, where each one corner had 3 doors, and then so all the plates were coming out of these doors, and it looked like it was like an infinite mass of plates coming out of a machine which had like refused to stop working.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like, it was really fun making that piece, but I would never ever be able to live from that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And I really like making in situ pieces, but I don't know. But it would suck for me to like say, oh, okay, I have to make these certain types of pieces.
Yeah.
Like I'd have to make objects that I could sell.
Yeah. And how, actually, for example, like an installation artist, how does a person go about making money from installations?
It's just a lot of installation art, is sort of, it's very, you build a reputation, pieces get bought by foundations, institutes, galleries, these sort of places.
Yeah.
And it's sort of just through building a reputation, and then you get invited to do installations in specific institutes,
mm-hmm.
or in specific galleries.
And so you kind of get paid from the people who enter to see the installation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, like a foundation or a gallery will buy your installation
or
pay you to do something on spot. And then, yeah, that's how you live from it.
Mm-hmm.
Which I quite like that.
Hmm.
But it's hard because there's a lot of politics on who you know and all that kind of stuff.
I imagine.
But that's in every industry. You have to network. You have to know people. The art industry is like any industry.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But the monetization of like specific pieces, I feel like art, I don't know, this is just from my perspective because I'm an installation sculptor, but I think that art is moving away from classical art like painting.
Mm-hmm.
But ceramics are coming back, but... I think really progressive art that sort of is pushing the boundaries isn't really in a format which can be commodified. So a lot of amazing digital art, it's not really in a format where you can like, oh, I'm going to buy a John Rathman video or something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of the real art that's pushing frontiers isn't in a format to be purchased. It's really only in a format which you can show in galleries, institutes, you know, these kind of places.
Yeah.
But like big installations or media art or digital art.
It becomes much more about the experience of seeing the art piece than about owning it. Which in a way is kind of beautiful, actually, I find.
Yeah.
Because it takes away from the material side of it. It's not just like, man, I bought this painting from Picasso, and like maybe the person
exactly
doesn't even care that much. They just see it as an investment.
Yeah.
And that's kind
of... No, but that's the thing when you like see the auction houses like Sotheby's and Christie's, and they sell like a Modigliani for like 200 million or something. I think, I don't know how much they went for, but it was over 200 million. And you're just like, why the hell are people paying that much? And then you realize, oh, it's just a way for very wealthy people to diversify their portfolio.
Exactly.
And it's just an investment. But that is so distant to the painter who made the art, what, I don't know, 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And died super young and never saw anything. Like, it's got nothing to do with him or nothing to do with the art piece. It's literally, it's got nothing to do with art, that kind of side of art.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a way for wealthy people to diversify portfolio. But I think, I don't know, I like the idea that art is about the experience and communicating a certain idea.
I also think it's quite cool.
Yeah.
What do you think of this trend nowadays of museums cashing in on the Instagram selfie movement, right? So like they'll make sure that the installation is selfieable, you know?
I don't know. I think it's a bit of a shame. As long as they're showing art that, I don't know, I wouldn't go to a museum if I want to see art that's pushing frontiers and stuff.
Yeah.
Because a museum is kind of the end result.
But in a way, it also attracts a group of people to the museum that would maybe not have gone. And they go because it's a popular movement and like, man, I'm going to go get my selfie at the museum.
I don't think people are that. That basically.
I don't think it's a majority of people. Like, but I imagine that like there are people that would do something like that, you know, they're just like, I'll just go because it's like something to post, you know.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's good because you're attracting more people to be exposed to art. Like maybe some people won't get it.
Yeah,
a lot of
people think that art is really in the dispersion or in the dissemination of it. So.
Mm. Because I went to Paris a few months ago and I went to the Orangerie where the Monet lilies are, right?
Yeah.
And
it was there long before Instagram.
Of course. And like, I was there, like, I love that.
It's beautiful.
It's just amazing. And I saw some people that go in and they take a picture of their bag with the painting in the background and then leave. And you pay 14 euros to get inside. And they didn't look at it. They just used it as a background. So
yeah, I feel like that's just a secondary scene that maybe is helpful for art.
Mm.
But I don't have enough proof of curators specifically curating exhibits on based off Instagram. It'd be funny. Like I saw a piece at the Saatchi Gallery where they presented a lot of the works through screens, and you could like the work through the screen pretty much as if it was an Instagram. Well, that was quite funny. I think that curators and I think they're very aware of sort of the reception and what it gets, and I don't think they would be as direct as doing that. I feel like it's pretty harmful to your reputation if you just chose things because they're Instagrammable.
Yeah.
I think a museum who already has a certain collection might rearrange things in a certain way to get more, I don't know.
For example, the Louvre, after the music video with Beyonce and Jay-Z, the Carters, I don't know what the music, the song was called. I think Arrest the Carters or something like that. And after that music video that was filmed in the Louvre, the museum made a tour called like the Jay-Z and Beyonce tour, where they just showed people like the paintings that appeared in the music video.
Yeah, it's quite funny they're catering to like a non-interest in art. So like, they're not interested in, that's not the primary reason they're going. As someone who makes art, this is so like different. Yeah, it's not what I think about when I'm making stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not my primary motivation. It's just sort of like it's just a secondary thing where I'm just like, oh, okay, that stuff happens.
Yeah.
But it's never going to change the way I make stuff. And I think it's just more reflective of an overall trend in how people view stuff, I guess.
Yeah. Well, thank you a lot.
Yeah.
I think that's it for today.
Cool.
And good luck with everything, man.
Thanks.
We're back in the house studio. That was a very good interview. Very interesting points.
Yeah, I definitely think it was very nice. I mean, it is art, so maybe some people were going to think that, man, art and design, they don't really mix. And I know this is like a design newsletter, but I think it was very interesting to see how coming from a different field can really help you to kind of propel yourself in a creative industry.
Yeah, I enjoyed his clarity.
Yes.
And you know, that maybe carried over from a more scientific background. Like, yeah. He was very clear on his perspective of things.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I think the part about, you know, like the popularization and, let's say, Instagramization
mm-hmm.
of art is very interesting, because like this is a new way of expressing yourself, right?
Yeah.
And like I enjoy the comparisons where, you know, like years ago people were all like reading the newspaper, now they're all looking at their phones, so the medium changed but the human behavior doesn't really change.
True.
And but at the same time, I also feel like sometimes you can see that only trying to make it more popular can take away a bit from the art, and also like these obscene prices and all this stuff are really, really, really far away from the artist. I think that was a very, very good point.
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, like I said, like the artist like died young and poor, and now like the painting goes for like 200 million is just, it's ridiculous. And
it's kind of ironic. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, and anywhere where people find value, where they, it becomes a commodity, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And I have nothing wrong with like finding a style, right? And then sort of exploiting that niche, because everyone wants to own a piece of you. So like, why not give it to them? I mean,
yeah.
Like it's a very Santa point of view.
Santa point of view.
but you know, I don't think that necessarily, like, it doesn't have to be unique in a way, to have value. But at the same time, like the talk about the democratization of art, like the new forms, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like a YouTube video or something where, you know, you can't really sell it and everyone can experience it. Like, I think that's beautiful. And I think we're living in a time, and we talk about this with you like all the time. Just like, you know, like this is the only time in the history of mankind, I think, where, you know, for example, like more money does not equal better. So imagine, like, you get like an iPhone XS or whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or a Google Pixel 3, like for like $1,000. There's nothing better. Like, there's nothing objectively, but that's,
yes,
as high as you can go.
Yeah.
And that's a price that most working people can afford if they wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
And that's ridiculous. Like, even if you're, you know, the Queen of England and you want to pay $1 million for a phone, like, you can get a bedazzled phone, but you can't get a better phone.
Of course, yeah.
And just like that, I think the same thing is happening to art, where, you know, before you could, if you had a lot of money, you could just commission an artist to live in your, you know, palace and get the best painting, and you would be the only one to look at it. But more and more, you know, if you have a computer, that's it. You have access to best art, all the art.
Yeah.
And no matter, and after that point, no matter how much you pay, like, you're not going to get something better. I think that's beautiful, and that's very unique of our times.
Hmm. I definitely think, like, many people will say that art is dead, and or like that's kind of people are running out of ideas, that sensationalism is kind of over now. Like, okay, everyone's seen like the installations with dicks and all this kind of stuff, right?
Yeah.
But I definitely think that this trend of experiencing art is really making art much more valuable as an intellectual kind of growth tool.
Yeah.
And many artists, like Olafur Eliasson, are kind of at the forefront of what art is today, where, like, you just, it's an installation where people can go feel it. You know, it's not just about, man, this looks really cool, I can maybe like buy it. And like, because in the past, like very, very past, right? In the very past.
In the extreme past.
Yes. Art was also a way of documenting
yeah,
a person. You know, like you commissioned a portrait and that was like your legacy.
Yeah.
Like, people would know your face because you commissioned a portrait, but now it's not like that anymore.
You can just take a selfie.
Yeah, you can just take a selfie.
Which is the new self-portrait.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's also interesting that, you know, we always have this, like, very high regard when anything is called, like, art, or, like, same for literature as well, right? But I also think that we have to kind of come to terms with the fact that, like let's say, like, that person who took, like, who used the Monet painting as a background liked it. mm-hmm. as a background. It's a painting. And I'm not saying this is the best use of that painting or the best way to appreciate it.
Yeah.
But like they appreciated the painting in a way that we didn't, right? They were like, wow, this is going to look great with my bag. Awesome. Well, I'll take a photo and I'm out of here. And like, it's not great, but it's very interesting, to say the least.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the end of the day, it's, you know, yeah, it's either very hyper-real or very surreal depiction of the world, of our times.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think it's an interesting way to look at it, where, you know, even if people just want to take a selfie with it, like, they want to document themselves with that artwork. It's, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
It's, I wouldn't just bash them immediately, is all I'm saying. Even though when I see it in person, I cringe a little bit too.
Yeah, yeah. And it's not a thing, it's not a generational thing, I think.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, everyone was doing the same thing, just with their own technology.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, you know, before that it was like, hey, like, you know, take a photo of me with this. Like, you remember the tourist, like, photos? Like,
there might have been a, like, this sort of mentality, but expressed in a way that we wouldn't be able to even imagine nowadays, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like having a picture taken with the Pisa Tower.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you're like, people, like, put their hands next to it and all this stuff.
Yes.
Like, I've done it when I was there. I was like, this is great. Of course I'm going
to do it. You have to do it.
And I feel like it's kind of great because you, like, I think the main idea there is that, like, you know, hey, I'm in the same place as this artwork, like for reals. And then you document it with, like, the technology that you have.
Yes.
And not everyone is doing it for the poetic side of it. But I think it's a poetic thing in the end, right?
Yeah. It would be really interesting if, I don't know, maybe like a new civilization in like thousands of years, they happen to find an archive of people holding up the Pisa Tower. And like, maybe they'll be like, oh my god, they had superpowers.
Yeah.
Or they'll be like, this Homo sapiens civilization really appreciated visual illusions, you know?
Which we do. We absolutely do. And
yeah.
And it's sort of a, you know, ritualistic religious activity.
Yeah, it's great, man. Like, it's just, it's very communal in a way that, like, everyone...
It's the thing, like, that brings people, us together.
Yeah, like, it brings us together. Like, many people have that picture with the Pisa Tower. It's great.
Yeah, exactly. I find that beautiful.
Shared experience.
Well, this is all we have for this episode. We hope you enjoyed it.